a documentary with former presidents and their staffs.
Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, November 5th, 2004, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, we're talking about the Digibar and Computer Museum in Boulder Creek, beautiful Boulder Creek, and its November 7th event, which is taking place in Mountain View, the first person shooter, Maze War, a 30-year retrospective. We have Bruce Damer here, the founder of the DigiBarn, to talk about that. And during the second half of the show, we'll welcome you to join our conversation with questions and comments about technology in general or about old computer games. The phone numbers to call in a little later in the show, if you'd like to jot them down now, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us to send us email. I'll give all that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com, and Miles Elam, a Java programmer, web developer, and student of American literature. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Oh, let me take your mics up so you can say that again.
Good morning.
Gentlemen, geeks. Can I use gentlemen with geeks? I think I can. Yeah.
There's gentlemen and geeks here because Bruce is here.
Oh, that's true. Bruce is here. But before we start talking with Bruce, though you're welcome to join in on the news, we're going to talk a little bit about geek news, what's happening in the technology environment this last week. John, I'm going to start with you.
Nothing actually happened
in technology last week.
And
Miles?
No. I think the voting had everyone pretty much tied up for the earlier part of the week.
You got anything happening in space?
In space, we have voting.
Excuse me?
Commander Leroy Chiao became the first American to vote for president from space. He did it on Halloween evening, his time, which was just after the polls opened, our time, because he's in space, he keeps different time than we do. He keeps Greenwich Mean Time. He cast it by an encrypted email. And it's not the first time a person has voted from space, but it's the first time a person's voted for president from space.
So okay.
It's that precedent.
Now, why can't I vote with electronic encrypted email?
Because you're not in space.
Ah, darn it. Location, location, location.
Right.
Thank you very much, John, for that. Miles?
Yes, the fight over peer-to-peer file sharing is heating up. The Motion Picture Association of America and Recording Industry Association of America will be sending out new lawsuits to individuals trying to shut down peer-to-peer file sharing. But in not unrelated news, the file sharing program called BitTorrent,
I know that application.
Yes, has grown to be what's estimated to be one-third the bandwidth on the internet.
Whoa.
Eclipsing all other peer-to-peer file sharing and completely blowing web traffic out of the water.
But how's it doing on email? Is it still beating email? Is it going to beat email, or is email still the number one sending or the number one traffic?
You know, off the top of my head, I don't know. I don't have that.
Well, it does make sense. BitTorrent has a pretty complicated structure, but it is to utilize, it's to use bandwidth as much as possible to
right.
share files.
Right. Or rather, not focusing that bandwidth on any single point.
Right. Right. It's distributed bandwidth usage. And it kind of makes sense. I mean, it's a pretty cool system. Maybe we should talk about BitTorrent sometime. I'm actually doing an event tonight at UCSC where we'll be talking quite a bit about BitTorrent.
Yeah, and let the record show that BitTorrent has many legitimate uses. It's not just for piracy. So,
name one.
Well, the fact that I was looking at it for putting on the GeekSpeak server, that way we didn't have huge bandwidth requirements for the audio.
All right, so new lawsuits coming out, not specifically about BitTorrent.
But about peer-to-peer file sharing. About sharing movies over the internet.
Right. All right, and not surprising. I mean, it seems to be that those corporations want to take care of their business model. So they will do everything they can legally and maybe
I think those corporations need a new business model because things have changed drastically since that original business model was made, but that's not now.
How shocking, John.
Okay.
Yeah,
sir?
Copyright law still applies. Long story.
Okay, anyway, John.
On Mars, the rovers are still going, and one of them has gotten a power boost unexpectedly. The rover Opportunity overnight experienced a what they're calling a cleaning event. They don't know what happened, really. It's getting 2 to 5% additional power all of a sudden.
Maybe after you're on Mars for a while, things get better or something.
they think that maybe wind has blown the dust off of the solar panels. You know, you're on Mars, dusty environment. The dust collects on the solar panels, which cuts down the amount of sunlight that can get through. Maybe the wind has blown off some of that dust. Or they're thinking maybe since it's in winter right now, frost has accumulated and has kind of granulated the dust that was on there. So I don't know. They don't really know, though, because they can't take a look at them.
No, and they know that it's gotten increased power because it's sending it back saying, I have this much power now.
Right. They monitor power.
What if it does? The sensors are wrong? I mean, couldn't it be other things? I guess NASA knows its beast pretty well.
Yeah, NASA knows. Well, and they have captive rovers, too. You know, we have rovers on this planet that we do experiments with. And to try and duplicate what's happening on Mars, we can try to figure things out. Right. So they can pretty much tell, no, the sensors are working. We're just getting more power.
Now, have any of these robots voted?
Not to my knowledge.
How un-American. Thank you very much, John. Miles?
According to this New Scientist article, TDK, a company.
When you say New Scientist article, is that a magazine?
The magazine New Scientist.
Okay.
There's an article about a company called TDK. It's the company that we all know from audio tapes and CDRs or recordable discs that have created a polymer that will be used for Blu-ray discs. That
the next DVD technology?
Right. That is, for all intents and purposes, it doesn't scratch and doesn't get affected and doesn't get marred by inks.
So it's magic. What do you mean doesn't get marred by inks?
Like, in this case, the author of this article, when shown a demonstration of it, was given a scouring pad and
Whoa.
A set of markers and was rubbing it as hard as he could and could not mar the surface.
What? What is this stuff?
It's
just new polymer?
Yes. It has it in the article. Unfortunately, I don't have it.
It's secreted from Superman's skin or something? Well, that's pretty cool.
It's
a mix
of silica microparticles 50 micrometers across, micrometers, or micrometers, yeah. And a solution
micrometers.
Of...
Micrometers. Go on.
Yeah, okay. And a fluorine-containing resin.
Ah.
So, you know, why that works, I don't know, and they're reluctant to do any specifics because they have a couple of patents.
I mean, if it's this strong, you could theoretically put plexiglass in houses now for windows and just coat them with it.
I don't know what the overall properties are, but they were talking about it for the screens to LCD panels and to cell phones.
Yeah, I would assume. Fascinating that kind of technology is emerging. I mean, new materials is probably going to be, in our lifetimes, probably going to be one of the most exciting changes to our environment. And this, of course, is just affecting CDs at this point, but it could be affecting a lot of things. Like, people normally get glasses for their, eyewear that are glass because they don't scratch, but then they're heavier on your nose. So then you can get plastic, but then they scratch. So there's a whole thing. But if you could get a polymer that makes it not scratch, pretty cool. Now, one more thing about DVDs and CDs. People have a tendency to flip them upside down, leave them upside down. If you've got a gold or silver-plated CD...
Upside down being the label part.
Label part down.
Right.
If it's got a paper label on it, that's fine. That's a good way to hold it. But don't leave it in the sun. But if it's gold or silver and you put it upside down, you're risking more than putting it face down because the actual reflective medium is that gold sheet or silver sheet. And if it flakes, your CD is ruined. So the best thing to do for a CDR is to put it back in a sleeve of some kind.
But when you get scratched on the bottom, that means that you have to take something that wears away.
Right. You can polish it, though. It's possible. Right. If you lose the silvering or golding layer on the top, it's impossible to recover the data. Thank you, Miles, for that. One more story from you, John, and another one from Miles, but go on.
All right. We have a new supercomputer on the horizon.
The Geeks do?
Ooh, that'd be nice. No.
Yeah. In operation, isn't it? It was sold in...
It's now in operation. This is BlueJean, IBM's new prototype, BlueJean L machine, has now been tested and shown consistent speeds of 70.72 teraflops. Teraflops is a trillion floating operation points per second. Is that what tera is?
Yes.
Gigas, billion, tera, trillion. Right. So a trillion operations per second. The current champion, which is Japan's Earth simulator, clocks up to about half that speed at 35.86 teraflops. To contrast that with technology, let's see, here we are. The first supercomputer, the Cray 1, which was in Los Alamos National Laboratory in 1976, had a speed of 80 megaflops, so 80 million operations per second.
Which any desktop computer today would completely trounce.
Right. So basically there's been about a 500,000 times increase in supercomputing power since 1976.
All right. Cool. Well, that's a good segue. Miles, you got one more story for us, though?
Yes.
Okay,
URL spoofing flaw. Found in Internet Explorer, and I just checked, it affects Safari as well.
Whoa.
This is one where, you know how when you mouse over, put the mouse cursor over a link,
yes,
and at the bottom, if you have a status bar, it will tell you where that link goes?
Yes.
Well, you can spoof that with some simple HTML.
Right, well, can't you just do it with JavaScript, too?
The thing is, this one doesn't require any scripting to be turned on.
Oh, interesting. This okay, so how is it done?
I don't want to completely describe it. I'll show it to you after the show.
Right. I expect a full write-up and detailed report.
But it doesn't affect Internet Explorer if you have Service Pack 2 installed. But pre-Service Pack 2, and since I'm completely up-to-date, I would say any version of Safari will have this bug.
Interesting. Now, that just basically means that paying attention to the status bar isn't necessarily true.
Right.
Not a big loss in my mind.
So after you click on a link, make sure you know where you're going. The issue, though, with Internet Explorer pre-Service Pack 2 is that you would look at the URL. It would look like the normal URL. You'd click on it, and it could send you someplace that performed an exploit and then redirected you to the actual URL. So you would not actually notice that you were hacked.
Right. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell, the Geeks this morning, John Tracy, and that was Miles Elam describing that interesting flaw. Thank you, Geeks, for the news this morning.
No problem.
Our guest, Bruce Damer, is the founder and operator of DigiBarn in Boulder Creek, a computer history museum, which does something unique in that, well, two things that I can think of off the top of my head. One, that it shares its space with pigs. It's a barn. And the other is that when it is in operation, when you go visit, when you contact first and say, we're coming over and I want to do this, they start turning stuff on. You actually get to play with this gear. So you get to see that first, you know, Commodore 64 that you might have owned at one point operating, and maybe a game that once run out. You can actually play with it. Pretty cool. So the DigiBarn's a great museum. You can learn more about the DigiBarn by going to digibarn.com. We have Bruce Damer, the founder, and they're doing a really cool event on November 7th, not in Boulder Creek, but in Mountain View at the Computer History Museum, a larger facility. Bruce, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
Bruce, first off, let's do a little rundown on DigiBarn. We had you on, I guess, right around when you founded it, via phone, I believe, and talked a little bit about it. That was more than a year ago, 2 years ago?
Yeah, that was, we were here, Galen and I were both about June or July of 2002.
Wow. Okay. So how's it going? How's this museum going?
It has expanded.
It has.
In fact, we don't pick up stuff on eBay anymore because it just gets donated. And we have just tremendous stuff, really rare stuff. Xerox Alto was donated. A lot of really weird stuff.
Now,
including, by the way, a Cray 1.
Cray 1 and Cray Q2 supercomputers.
You have two Cray.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
Yeah. When I was there, when your grand opening kind of thing, it seemed really packed with people, but also equipment. I don't know, where are you putting all this stuff? Where are you putting new stuff?
There's sort of a staging area where the boxes come. We break it out. We photograph it. The whole point of the DigiBarn is to get it up on the net to get as much material available to the public as possible.
What about manuals? Like, let's say I've got one of these old machines, but I have no manual for it, and I'm trying to, like, fix something, or, like, even a schematic or something. Are you trying to keep that kind of resource online as well?
Not really. There's a guy named Salam Ismail who runs the Vintage Computer Festival, which is doing the main event this weekend, and he just is the expert on that. He just has, he's like, rooms of manuals. So we mainly focus on the running artifacts just to get people to tell their stories.
Right. All right. Let's talk about the Vintage Computer Festival. It's the 7th annual Vintage Computer Festival. And it's basically getting people that would like your museum, for example, getting together and doing events that celebrate history of computers.
Yeah, in fact, it's great. I mean, you've got speakers, you've got a whole exhibit area with running systems. I mean, beautifully restored systems. It's like going to an old car show and someone's got a 1937 Cord and it's like got all the original parts on it.
People bring their own computers?
Yeah, they have restored computers and, running. I mean, guys with mini computers, like whole deck PDP-11s working.
Oh, great. You know, great.
It's a big effort to haul these things in there, but it's a wonderful, wonderful fun time.
A PDP-11 is how big?
Well, some of them can be like 8 feet tall or like big racks.
Think like an old phone booth.
Yeah, how do they move these things?
There's, the Computer History Museum's got great lifts and guys, and they know how to do that.
So they're setting up in the main hall space for this?
Yeah, upstairs.
Upstairs, okay.
And upstairs and downstairs, it just keeps growing. The festival keeps growing.
Let's talk real quick. I want to touch base real quick on the Mountain View Computer History Museum, computerhistory.org, I believe it is.
Yes.
It's a privately funded, by people with deep pockets, museum that does very similar to what the DigiBarn does, but it's much more in the strict museum guidelines where the equipment's not turned on normally. So they've got a lot of machines sitting in what they call public storage or
Visible storage.
Visible storage. So you basically look at what's being stored. And then they have a lot of events in this space. It's a really nice building. It's in Mountain View. I think that space is free. It's donation only. And then they host things that bring in some revenue, I think, to help support it, but probably not supporting the entire cost. And this computer, this Vintage Computer Festival on the 6th and 7th this weekend, is one of these events where you'd have to pay to participate in that.
Yeah, I think
but it's pretty cool.
It's like a $10.
It's pretty cheap, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty. And it's just off Shoreline, 101 and Shoreline. It's right in that old SGI sales headquarter building.
And you can get all the URLs for all this stuff by going to geekspeak.org today and clicking around. You'll find it no problem. So the part of the Vintage Computer Festival that you're participating in or that you're kind of sponsoring, I guess, is this retrospective on the first-person shooter.
Yeah. In fact, every year I seem to come up with a crazy idea. Like last year it was the Xerox Alto computer, you know, the computer that everything was born on, really. I said, wait a minute, it's 30 years old this year, no one's having a birthday. We even had a cake with the Alto printed on it. Like, you know how you can make a photograph and
sure,
a cake?
Sure.
And this year it's like my weird nerd brain coming up with what important anniversary of some underappreciated thing is coming up? Maze War. Nobody knows about Maze War.
So that's what you try to celebrate is the birthday parties, basically.
Birthday parties. And for this one, I'm just blown away. All the original people who wrote Maze War and who ported it at MIT. And
they're coming?
They're all coming to speak in a panel at 1 o'clock on Sunday.
And you would have to get into the Vintage Computer Festival showroom to do that. But so it's Sunday at 1?
Sunday at 1 is that.
So
but we're going to be
a computer enthusiast, if you're a geek, this is a great experience, great event. And if you haven't been to the Computer History Museum, wonderful space. I highly recommend doing this.
And if you play the current versions of first-person shooter games, it's nice to go and pay homage to where it all began.
Let's define first-person shooter. Miles?
Where it's, from your point of view, usually the most common ones are the ones where you're holding a gun. But
hence the shooter part of it.
First-person shooters, I mean, that's...
Yeah, it's like, you basically, it's your point of view walking around.
Yeah, so I guess, it wasn't Wolfenstein, there was one before that. I'm trying to remember the name of it.
Maze War.
Of course, what we're talking about.
But so basically, this game is, it's normally a pseudo 3D or very 3D looking environment, and you don't see necessarily, I mean, in Maze War you do see your character, but you don't necessarily see your character. You represent, you're doing a POV of the character, and you're walking through a maze, and in this one, you run into other people that are actually not computers, but avatars of real people, and you tried to kill them. So that's the general thing. It's pretty...
No, you try to blow up their avatars.
Trying to blow up difference. Their... They're trying to blow up their eyeball. It's pretty... It's pretty innocuous.
What's really interesting about it is, you know, they talk about early life on Earth, that life arose on Earth exactly when it could. You know, the oceans weren't boiling anymore, and boom, you had life. And Nazvor was created on the Imlac PDS-1, the very first computer with a graphical vector-based display that could be networked. And boom, these guys at NASA Ames just put this game together on this thing. And initially it was a single-player thing. It was like, oh, it's boring. You just solve the maze. Hey, we can connect these two machines together.
If computers disappeared, network disappeared, and it rebuilt, would you say that as soon as a machine that had vector and network, this would just emerge again?
It's instantaneous.
I like that. Yeah. So, but the guys that actually wrote it, they were working for who? For where?
They were at NASA Ames.
Okay.
And it was what was interesting was that this game is like the meme that won't die. Do you realize it's on the Palm OS? And in front of me now, I have it. The guys built a version in Java. That actually, the Java version will run on OS 10 or Windows or whatever. It will play via the net with a version on the original machine, which is in Indiana.
Wow.
And the original, because...
That's like the first machine that ever had it on there.
The first machine that ever had it. The original code, it will play it. And that, in fact, that machine is being shipped, and it's actually here in California now for
It's going to be there. Oh, great.
Can you imagine that?
So talk about backwards compatibility.
Yeah, talk about it. Well, it's a very simple game, and... They were playing between MIT and University of Southern California over the very early ARPANET.
Right.
They were playing Maze War, and the net latency was so bad in the mid 70s that the U.S. people had a real disadvantage in the game.
Anybody remote was just not doing so well.
Yeah, and all the aficionados, like Licklider and the famous people who were running the MIT computer science, like. And DARPA people like didn't consider that this was a very good use of the investment on the IMLAC and these expensive graphic workstations and ARPANET.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But Licklider was seen after hours playing Maze.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But there you have it. You have this kind of weird juxtaposition of the massive multiplayer game. It wasn't very massive in terms of Maze. And the serious use. So what do we have today on the net? The same kind of...
Right.
At the same time, let's give credit where credit's due. This is the first the first generation that has led to, for example, planetary simulations, where you're actually... Or graphical ones, anyway. Ones where you can see satellites in orbit around the Earth, for example, or zooming in and out of a real estate venture.
Are you saying that stuff all kind of spawned from this or grew from this?
This is the first generation. This is what pushed the state of the art for people to say, I want this to look better. I want this to look better.
Yeah, and games are very definitely still doing that same thing. Actually, first-person shooters is a big driving feature on why graphics cards are getting better and better all the time.
Because
the game industry is so large.
What's amazing is in the Digibarn we have these Krays from 76, and the graphic, a regular GeForce card, has so much more power than the Cray supercomputer. And the real economic drive, the Moore's Law, the huge surge in power, isn't in processors running Word.
Right.
Because you don't see much change, right, from 10 years. You don't really see much change, but it's in those 3D chipsets.
Right.
So
it's the spawn of these of this maze game, really, that
is pushing the envelope. If we're going to get artificial intelligence or bizarre things emerging in the 21st century, and they're going to look back and... Like, we're going to be the carbon units, and they're going to see maize, and they're going to see, that's the first life form.
Right. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're opening the lines for calls and questions about, probably old technology, old computers, I think is what we're talking about today. But you're welcome to call about any kind of questions, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
Students at CSUMB's Service Learning Program will sponsor a panel discussion called The Faces of Homelessness on Wednesday, November 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the University Center Living Room, Building 29, on 6th Avenue on the CSUMB campus. For information, call 582-4183.
This is American Life. David Sedaris' sister tells him a personal story with one caveat.
If you ever, she said, ever repeat that story, I will never talk to you again. Oh, come on, I said. It's not like you're going to do anything with it.
Apologies. And when they're doomed to fail...
That's This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
You're listening to KUSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio. And Geek Speak's on right now. I'm Lyle Troxie, your host. The geeks this morning are John Tracy and Miles Elam. We're talking with Bruce Damer about old computers. You're welcome to join our conversation, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us email. Just go to geekspeak.org. This program is supported by a grant from Cruzio, providing internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruzio membership is available online at cruzio.com or by calling 459-6301. Bruce, I know that moments from now people are going to call in with questions about old computer history stories and thoughts and concerns, and I kind of want to talk about that myself, so I'm going to start first off with Miles. Miles, what was your first computer?
The first computer in the house, or was the first one that I...
First in the house.
First in the house.
That you remember touching.
Was an Exidy Sorcerer.
What is that?
Ah, we have a couple of those.
Right, what is it?
It is a Z80 machine. And ours predated the tape decks, or actually we had a floppy drive. They had a tape drive, except that there wasn't a dedicated one. My dad simply bought a commercial tape deck and put in the audio connectors. Think of your modem goes over a phone line and has frequency modulation on that. Or
It makes noise.
It makes noise, which sends data, which carries data. Same thing, only you're going from a tape deck to the computer.
Right. And it was a pretty common thing, actually, because cassette tapes were really quite common things. And so storage, that was a good storage medium.
Yeah, learned how to play blackjack at the age of four.
Yeah, and the Exidy Sorcerer was sort of deep sixed, as in a first-person shooter by the IBM PC, which went through the maze of all these little computer companies and killed them all off.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
The IBM PC, when that was announced,
destroyed all these.
Oh, there were like 60 companies that were extinct within a few years, and right. One of them was the people that made Exidy Sorcerer.
So it was only a short run of computers being generated, and those engineers probably went off to IBM.
Yeah, it was like a Cambrian explosion of diversity, and then now today what we have is locked in monopolies.
Right.
We had our K-Pro 3 a few years after the IBM PC was introduced. We had that for several years, actually.
Yeah, so you shouldn't have bought that.
Hey, it worked great.
Yeah.
It's all right. IBM machine.
John, is your first computer as amazing as Miles?
No, my first computer was actually the Atari 2600 game console.
Yes, game console.
But my first actual computer was the VIC-20.
VIC-20. Commodore I had the VIC-20 as well. Everyone always talks to me about the VIC-64. I didn't have a VIC-64. I had a VIC-20.
My dad, who worked in the aerospace industry, he had a portable Commodore 64, which was this, I don't know, it was kind of like a briefcase-sized computer.
Yeah, SX-64.
Yeah. And it had, what was it, like a 5-inch TV in it, computer TV that was the display, and a big, I think it had a 12-inch floppy drive. Maybe it was only 5.5.
I think it's fascinating that those consoles had their output as a composite video signal, so you just plug it right into your TV. It was so easy. I think they even broadcast the channel 3 because there wasn't TV inputs at that point. So it had a small transmitter. UHF?
Yeah.
Is that right, Bruce? Do you remember how those things work?
Yeah, it was just a little silver adapter box.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and now you got to buy.
TV. That's right. Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, and now you got to buy, a pretty expensive car to do video out on your computer. I mean, it's normally not kind of a standard thing unless you're using a Mac. But
the resolution was also much, much lower.
It wasn't so impressive.
NTSC 512 lines. Really fuzzy.
Really fuzzy.
You know, that said, though, I lost so many hours to Adventure, which is Atari 2600 game. It didn't matter that the graphics suck. You didn't know, actually, because the graphics were top-notch then.
Right. I have an old family friend who did special effects for the movie industry. He actually did things like war games. He did all the computer effects for war games. And he was so taken back by the VIC-20 and that kind of line of computers, that era,
that he went ahead and bought one for us and shipped it up to us, to my parents and the family. And so we had this computer, even though we were hippie kids that, you know, did a lot of nonprofit support in the area. We had this computer, and I'm sure that that spawned me to be a geek. I did a lot of programming on it. It's interesting to see these, you know, early adopting geeks then see the machines come out that, wow, that could be owned by a family. People could actually own these things. And they got so excited that they spawned off.
Interesting, this Maze War is a lot of people who saw that. It was profound. It, the game Zork, the company
Zork.
Founded in 79, and it was inspired by Maze War and the people who had seen it. So there's actually this whole lineage of people who experienced this sort of primal excitement of, I'm an eyeball and I'm chasing another eyeball and I can peek around the corner and I can shoot. And that it had been invented spontaneously. And that meme got them to start game companies.
Yeah.
Because they remembered that excitement from the 70s. And
right.
So the
and
whole
Zorkby is a whole, was a whole franchise. I don't know if it's still going now, but it was.
Oh, it's still going.
It's still going. It's a good, it was a good, I mean, I've played a couple of them. They're good games.
There are a lot of folks out there who kind of know what a GRU is, but kind of not. The Faithless Enemy.
Oh, okay.
By the way, to experience the excitement of the original Maze War on the digibarn.com site, we'll have the Java version for anyone to download.
Great.
And you can run it on your own system and or on your own home network. And it's not too exciting, but
it's neat to be able to network something like that, though.
Yeah.
Most people, especially free games at this point, most of them are not networkable. You know, the games that people play are very commercialized, and this is a really quite an interesting thing to participate in.
So, Bruce, what was your first computer?
Oh, my first computer was a PDP 1134 from the 70s.
This wasn't a home computer.
It wasn't a home computer, and it was great. It had accounts, and I spoofed the login screens of the other students. So, you know, you build a fake. What you do is you start your account up on all the computer terminals,
mm-hmm.
and then you have a login where they'll put their name and password, but it's your account running.
Right.
And then you'll actually even allow them to list files and start stuff up, and then you'll suddenly put up a notice that the system's going down for maintenance.
Uh-huh.
And then you'll log yourself off, and then when they come back up, they go back into their account. They never know. And then, of course, I sent the list of passwords and accounts around to everybody.
To show them that the system had been breached.
Yeah, that everybody got access
Bruce,
to everything.
Bruce, you hacker, you. All right, you got a story about your old computer or technology? Well, in general, questions for us geeks. We can answer anything. Phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. No one is online right now, so you call right now and we'll answer your question. Maybe we'll answer it accurately. If you'd like to send us email, you're welcome to go to geekspeak.org and click on contact us. We're talking
except the server appears down, or never mind, it's just my net connection.
Your net connection's bad.
Okay.
Yeah, you're not actually plugged in at this point.
Let me wiggle the jack.
All right. we're talking with founder of the Digibarn, Bruce Damer, about about Maze War, a 30-year-old first-person networked game. And you're welcome to contact us and talk to us about your experience with first gaming or your first computer. And I welcome the old early adopters of computer people. But anybody, you can ask a question about Windows if you'd like, printing, whatever.
Actually, I have just a not really related trivia question. With your knowledge of the PDP-11, I'm wondering, was it the PDP-11 or the PDP-9 that only supported 6-character commands? Because back when Adventure was first being introduced, you couldn't type Adventure at the command line. You typed Advent.
I think it was earlier. Well, Steve Wozniak would know. Should get him on the show. He knows the PDP-8 backwards.
Yeah. Do you know Steve?
I keep bumping into him, and he keeps saying, I got to come up to Digibarn.
All right. Well, when you have him up, we'll have him on. That would be great to have Steve Wozniak on GeekSpeak. Miles, I want to get to the jux of why we get so excited about this thing. Why are you interested in what machine actually breached that 6-character limit?
It's genetic.
Well, I think of, say, an art history major that thinks, when was realism first important? Or when was a particular style brought forth?
Yeah.
It's just one of those where you see something that is very pervasive in the world, something that affects the way you see the world, the way that everyone sees the world. But everyone seems to take it for granted because this is how it is today. But you know that in the past there was a transition point. So it's a just noting history.
Bruce, the cray that you actually have two crays in your barn. Do you still have pigs in your barn, or are they?
They are in the horse stalls, and they go out into the garden area.
Okay.
They actually don't. Occasionally, Mama will get through the stall, and she'll wander around, and she looks up at the cray. But usually they're
she
not.
Doesn't interface with it, though.
I think she has a real primal understanding of it somehow.
Kind of like a cow in a bookshop.
Have you ever considered actually power? I mean, have you ever powered up the crays?
No, they're not powerable. You need a diesel generator set. You need a
some
coolant
high voltage
system. You need 483 phase power. And
483 phase power?
Yeah.
What the heck is that?
480 volts.
Wow.
Is that three phase or is that more than three phase?
I think it's three phase.
So 480 volts, three phase, and a cooling system, a liquid cooling system.
Yeah, you in 1980 you need about $30,000 a month in consumables.
To run a cray one. Well, you can't afford that? So that's one of the machines that's not powered up. Do you have any other machines that you can't really power because it's too...
Occasionally, the problem with these old systems, I mean, you'll power them up and they'll pop a cap or something will burn out. And then you need to find the expert to come in and baby it to get it going. It is a real challenge.
Yeah. Do you try to keep all your machines running?
Yes. Yep.
How do you deal with moisture and such in a barn?
It's difficult. You know, I would love to get a grant from any Deep Pockets persons out there to finish up our barn and seal off some of the rooms so we don't have to deal with it. But we just have to keep maintaining and keep our documents in the winter in sealed containers so they don't get the moisture.
You're welcome to join the conversation. Yes, it's any questions about technology in general, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. From Monterey, welcome Becky to Geek Speak.
Hi, Becky.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
What's your question?
It's not a very complicated one, but I'm considering, I am going to buy a laptop PC.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just wondering if you have any words of advice on what I should get, where I should go.
I think that's a complicated question.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, good job on the question. Do you have any, what are you going to use it for? That's the first question.
Pretty much going to be personal use, just documents, word processor. I do have email,
No video editing, no 3D game development.
No games. I do like to once in a while burn some CDs.
Okay, so you want a CD burner? You know that, and
yeah.
How often and how far are you going to travel with this? You're going to be taking it on the plane a lot?
I will not. It won't be mobile. I'll just keep it at home. I just have a small place, and I don't have room for the big monitor and the tower and all that anymore.
Okay, so that's why you want to get a laptop just for size, not really for portability. So you don't really care about battery life because you all have it plugged in all the time.
Right.
So pretty much anything with a 15 or 17-inch screen for you.
15 or 17 inch, okay.
Yeah, and it's important since this is going to be your primary monitor, the LCD screen.
Uh-huh.
It's really important that you get to sit down in front and look at look at the screen and say, oh, this is really nice. I like the way this looks.
Yeah. The other thing is you could try to get a machine that has a video out and get a larger monitor, so you could get but then you're going to deal with.
You can get an LCD.
You don't want a big monitor. Yeah.
But you can get an LCD display, which is really small considering this.
Yeah, but I guess since you're really trying to maintain the size as really small, then I would go ahead and get I'd get a 15-inch. 17-inch laptops are just expensive. Bruce, do you have any suggestions on a laptop?
Well, you know, I get Dells, but...
You're using a Dell in front of you right now.
The Mac PowerBooks are looking better and better. I mean, they're going to run better on battery, and GOS 10 is looking really nice these days.
Yeah, but you do want a PC, is that right?
Yes, I do.
I think the Dells are, ThinkPads are more rugged, but you're going to pay a little extra premium for them. But I just am really happy with the Dells that I've had.
We've had good luck with the Compacts as well.
What do you think about going wireless? Like, I do like a mouse. I just like that little thing to use.
Right.
Because I'm just not used to it.
So you'll plug in a mouse, okay.
Yeah. So is it a good idea? I mean, is it okay to have a wireless mouse with a laptop?
It's fine to have a wireless mouse with a laptop. It's a little strange because you're going to have to get this, like, external dongle thing that plugs into your laptop, and then you have your mouse wireless, and that little dongle thing is going to be, like, 3 feet long, and it's going to look like a mouse, and it's going to stick out of your laptop. So it's kind of like the only thing is that you'll be able to put it behind the machine instead of to the side. I wouldn't get a wireless laptop. I mean, I wouldn't get a wireless mouse for a laptop. I think it's a little...
Okay.
Yeah, because you have batteries to worry about in the mouse.
But you'll probably be hard-pressed to find a laptop at this point that doesn't have Wi-Fi or wireless networking. And that would be kind of a nice thing if you want to do updates and such, which you'll need to do every once in a while. Even if you don't have a fast connection at home, you can go down to a local shop, local like coffee shop that has free network access and download your service packs and everything from there. So, but basically, go ahead and get something with Wi-Fi. I don't know if you'd be able to find a new one without Wi-Fi, really.
Yeah, it's just built in.
Yeah. So that's the wireless that most people are talking about, not normally wireless peripherals.
Okay.
Like the mouse. So, yeah, I think that's our recommendation. I like that Bruce had a real, actual, like, firm, fast, he likes Dell, which is nice, because you don't normally hear that on GeekSpeak. We're trying to be a little less direct, unfortunately. I hope that answers your question, Becky.
Yeah, can I mention a business where I think I might go?
Sure,
please. Am I allowed to do that on the air?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I was considering going to PC People.
PC People.
Don't know them.
You don't know them? They're down here in Monterey.
Okay, so it's a local shop in Monterey?
Yeah.
I always like the idea of supporting a local computer shop because you get people that know what's going on, and there's a small enough staff that you actually can, you know, you're not talking to someone that doesn't have any idea about computers. So right. If that's the kind of environment that company is, I think a great idea. What the name of the company again?
PC People.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you can find a local group like that, you're lucky because there aren't that many of them.
Yeah, they're
good. I've always gotten my computers from them in the past,
right.
and it's personal service and all that kind of stuff, and they seem to be very knowledgeable.
Thank you very much, Becky, for the call.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Well, and from Monterey again, Kim, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. How are you?
Quite well. What can we do for you today, Kim?
Well, this is a Mac question, so the Mac guru has to put his hat on. This is an old...
Let's get John on the headphones so he knows that it's a Mac question, John.
What?
Yep. Okay, go ahead. Go
he
for
there?
It, Kim. Yep, he's
okay.
there.
So here's the deal. Back in the day, I still have it. I have so many Macintoshes over the years. I never sell the old ones. I just keep them. And I have an old 840 AV, which at the time was pretty progressive because it had the AV part, right?
I had one of those. Those things rock.
Okay, so,
you could start a computer museum.
I know. I even have the Millennium, you know, with the Bose sound system Macintosh.
The 20th anniversary?
Yeah, the 20th anniversary. I'm
Ooh, you're looking for one of those. Still.
Everybody, yeah, that's actually a collectible computer.
I absolutely love it. I put all my music on there, and it's got this Bose system. That's my bedroom computer. Right?
If you still have the box for it, it's worth a lot.
I don't have the box for it, unfortunately, but... it's not going anywhere. Anyway, so I have this 840 AV, and back in the day, you could go to your system folder, and you could go to sound, and you could record your own alert sounds.
Right.
You remember this?
Sure.
Okay, you just get a little microphone. And that was, 12 years ago. And so I had my daughter at the time, who was just a little baby, make all these alert sounds, like, uh-oh, and, you know, singing
right.
songs and whatnot. I can't get, now I would love to get those off of there and burn them onto a CD, but they're not, I can't access these files. I've done
right.
every kind of search I can do. I don't know where they live, and I don't know how to get them off
Does the machine
there.
Still play the files?
Oh, yeah.
What right. operating system
get
were you
Get a
running?
Microphone.
No. What operating system were you running on this?
Oh, you know
seven
what?
Seven something? Eight
I,
something?
Yeah, or? It would be seven something. I'm in the
they're
car.
Actually,
you guys never... I'm never at home when the show is on, so I'm on the road right now, so I don't actually have the machine in front of me.
I hope you're not driving. We'd like it if you're not driving while you're on.
No, I'm not, actually.
Okay,
thank you. Okay, first of all, you can email us, geeks@geekspeak.org, and uh-huh. we will give you all this information in writing. But
okay.
what you need to do is go into the operating system, you know,
right.
into the system folder, and inside that is the system suitcase.
Okay.
It's just called system, and if you look at the icon closely, it looks like a little suitcase. You can double-click that. Your fonts and sounds are both stored inside that.
Okay.
And then you can copy them out of there. You can't move them out of there while the operating system is running, but you can, let's see.
Select
if you're,
and copy.
If you're running 8.6 or later, you can hold down the Option key and drag
right,
them out.
Right, move them and drop, yeah.
Or
yeah.
you can do a copy and paste, I think.
Yeah.
Now, can you open the system folder in 7? I thought you needed a Rosetta or something.
No, you can open the system folder in 7.
I never did that.
Yeah, it's a suitcase. So the sounds and your fonts should both be in there.
Great, John, you're great.
So, all right, well,
Kim, good luck. You know, Kim, if that doesn't work, of course, you know, a microphone.
No, please email if that doesn't work, okay. And we'll make it work.
Kim, thank you very much.
I had the exact same thing. We had an old machine that my son had done a lot of things on, and I wanted to get those off of there. And so it's the same way. Kids' noises make such great system beeps.
That's because you're a father.
I'm a geek.
Yeah. But, you know, I haven't had my son do that. I'm going to have to do that. Sound recording stuff. Do you get people that, I mean, in this kind of question is a perfect example of computers getting old quickly. I mean, your entire museum, nothing's older than 50 years, right?
Right, yeah, and boy, I'll tell you, there's so many old formats and stuff that is locked and trapped. And in fact, the Xerox Alto is a good example. It has the first word processor, the first Ethernet, the first like email systems and visual editors and visual music composers, and they're all trapped on these huge platters, these 2.5 megabyte platters.
You can't get the data off?
Well, a team actually recently built a rig where they actually dumped the platters to images.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another effort that we're involved in to build a version of the Alto operating system in Java that can actually go and read these images as though they're real Alto disks.
Okay.
And bring back things like Bravo, which is the first word processor.
Right.
First visual processor.
So that's a real, and it's a real problem.
It's a real problem. And luckily, the game industry, like, you can get these Commodore 64 emulators, and because there's such a big market, you can emulate anything, and those things are still alive, but some of the real historic systems are just, they're dead media unless you do the work.
Speaking of old games and being able to access them, but basically what happens is the ROM instruction set, the instructions that are actually on the ROM, you copy those off to your computer as a file, and then you get an emulator that acts like that system and runs that little ROM. And it's pretty simple to do because most of those games were all designed for one system, and like all these computer game, video console kind of computer games, the instruction set's the same on all of them, so it's really quite easy to do this. And you can get thousands of them. Our geek Sean has thousands of these games that you can play at any point. But really fun. If you're curious about that, you can go to, anyvideogame.com, I believe, is a great source for those, learning more about that. What right now in your museum are you looking for and do you want?
Oh, gosh.
Do you have a short list?
There is a short list. In fact, we're doing a whole display on mobile systems. So we're looking for Go and Momenta. We just got Gavilan mobile computers. We have some grids.
What's a grid?
Ralph Abraham, who was on your show a couple of weeks ago, donated his grid Compass 2. And it's the first laptop. Basically, it opens up like these laptops.
Right.
It doesn't have a handle, but it's from 1981, 82. It has a beautiful case.
Are those the ones with the orange display?
Orange display.
Wow.
It had operating systems built into little ROM chips.
Uh-huh.
And they cost about $9,000 or $10,000. They were carried around by generals in the Pentagon with no handle.
How did Ralph get a hold of one?
Well, Ralph has some great systems. He has a complete Next network, and I don't know how he had this grid. Maybe it was paid for by some grant or something.
Right.
But
very possible. He's been on the cutting edge of mathematics and computers. So
yeah, he's been on the cutting edge a lot. So
you've just mentioned something I want to touch on. The worst case for me would be to forget what it was, and I cannot remember what it was. Stumped. When people donate stuff, do you give them, like, I mean, you're a nonprofit, do you actually give them a tax break, or is it really just people that want to support this stuff staying around?
We're actually the group of us, and there's Alan Lundell and about dozens of people who are working on this. It's a community-based effort.
Uh-huh.
We're considering creating a nonprofit for the storytelling part, because we get thousands of hours of video and audio of people who come, and we interview them, and we're scanning pictures all the time and whatever. It's just a vast amount of material to process, and we really need to get some grants.
So that you can put that stuff online and
put that stuff online.
Huh?
And the collection, some of the items in the collection are, you know, belong to other people who are just putting them there. So really the collection isn't owned by anybody. It's owned by a collective.
So it's kind of just a, it's kind of the grassroots feeling of an organization. It's not structured in the federal
sense. It's not structured in the federal. It's not a federal case.
Well, Bruce, this event that or this event of the Vintage Computer Festival. Do you know much more about that thing and what other speakers are happening and things of that nature? What are you excited about for that event?
Oh, what I'm excited about. I mean, just the energy these people have shown. The fact that they've got the original system working. They built a whole new system in Java that they're going to tell these stories. The stories are hilarious about the shenanigans around Maze War. It sounds, what they're talking about in the early to mid-70s sounds like today, 30 years later.
The same things are happening.
You know, you remember a few years ago the As We May Speak, As We May Think article, Vannevar Bush, in the 1945, it was hauled out about 10 years ago and said, this guy was talking about the internet. In 1945, he was talking about the Memex, and you could click on links and stuff.
Sure.
Well, in a sense, Maze War is the As We May Think for gaming. For online gaming and online virtual communities and avatars. It really is. So what is going to happen on Sunday is the reemergence of this great papyrus roll of of the first one. And our goal is that when people are writing the histories, now they're going to have first-person account of the first-person shooter, and people who made it talking, we're going to have video cameras rolling.
Okay, so you're archiving this information.
Absolutely, right. And it'll all be on the site and so that this people understand where the heck did all this come from.
And joining you for this, it will be Greg Thompson and Howard Palmer. Can you talk a little bit about who those guys are?
Yeah, those are some of the originators who wrote the code for the IMLAC version and then at MIT. In fact, Greg carried paper tapes, I believe, to MIT, which then got created in the MIT version.
Cool, very cool. And the event, of course, is this. They're speaking this Saturday or Sunday?
They're speaking on Sunday.
Okay, because the event says Saturday. The website seems to say that it's on Saturday, which is a little...
Well, it starts...
Oh, no, it's Sunday. Oh, that's right. Sunday,
yeah, all weekend you'll be able to see Maze running, but Sunday's our big day with a 1 p.m. Panel. And then the cake cutting afterwards.
What's the cake going to be this year?
The cake, and you can actually see the image that we're going to publish. It actually shows Maze War with an eyeball. It shows the Xerox workstation version. It'll be printed on the cake and cut by the original people. The cake art.
Cake art. And that's going to be a scan and print onto a computer.
Yeah, just in confectioner sugar. They could print on cakes. You should have someone in here.
I got to find out how that's done. I know it's wonderful, wonderful stuff. All right, the event, again, is at the Computer History Museum, which is in Mountain View. You can learn much more about this whole thing by just going to geekspeak.org and clicking on today's show. It's the Vintage Computer Festival 7.0. I love that they do the what year it is by the nomenclature for software normally. 6th and 7th. And the speaking about this subject of the Maze first-person shooter, Bruce Damer and some of colleagues will be there talking about that on Sunday. You're welcome to join it. And if you don't make it out this weekend, I highly recommend going to Mountain View Computer History Museum. It's a wonderful little experience. And if and when, you don't have normal times for the DigiBarn, correct?
Well, we're going to have an open house on Monday.
Monday.
For the people who have come, you have to go to digibarn.com, DigiBarn.com, and go into contact, send us a form, and say you'd like to come to open house and get on our mailing list. And that's
how you do it.
That's how we do it.
Okay, so basically you've got to kind of register before coming.
Yeah, you got to let us know because it's not really...
It's not staffed or anything.
It's not staffed. And the pigs are getting trained up, but they're just not very good at giving the tours.
Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Our geeks today were John Tracy and Miles Elam. Our guest, Bruce Damer, is one of the founders of the DigiBarn. You can learn more about the DigiBarn at digibarn.com. That's a www.digibarn.com. And, of course, you can go to this event at the 7th Annual Vintage Computer Festival at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, 6th and 7th, to learn much more about computers and the history that, well, is only 30 years. I mean, it's recent history, so it's live, and it's quite interesting. Community Alliance with Family Farmers provided a grant for this program. Buying fresh and local produce from farmers markets CSAs, retailers, and restaurants supports the local economy. For information about the Buy Fresh, Buy Local campaign, 761-8507 or online at caff.org. I want to thank the geeks this morning for being here, and Bruce Damer, thank you very much for being here on Geek Speak. To all of you that called in, all three of you from Monterey, thank you very much for listening to Geek Speak, for calling and participating, letting us sound like experts that we think we are. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, or on the web at KUSP.org. We'll be back next week at 10 a.m. on Friday. Coming up next is Open Road, and at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. For KUSP and Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Here's some NPR news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat remains in critical condition.